Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I appreciate being here this morning. My name is Michael Donahoe. I'm from the Federal Defender's Office in Helena. This is kind of a complicated case. Sometimes I think it's just a really simple case, but sometimes when I get the papers out and start looking at it, it seems kind of complicated. As the Court is aware, contextually here we have two cases brought seriatim by the government dealing in each instance with child pornography charges. The first case was inspired by some state allegations that this individual, Mr. Carpegna, had touched a child. He was arrested. His house was searched in connection with that offense, that state court offense. That computer was seized pursuant to that search, that HP Pavilion computer. It came into possession of the United States. It was analyzed to contain child pornography. And through several months, the government investigated that, finally did bring an indictment to which Mr. Carpegna pled guilty, reserving a suppression claim in the context of that case. After he was sentenced, Mr. Carpegna, in October of 07, in the next year, 08, another case was brought involving a different computer. That computer had been taken from Mr. Carpegna when he was arrested on the first indictment. And I'm sure that the panel is aware of these facts. They're well set forth, I think, both in our brief and the government's brief. We bring three claims today, one involving the suppression paper, one involving the double jeopardy claim, and one involving a sentencing issue, a Davenport issue. I don't intend to address the Davenport issue. It's conceded, so I'll just leave it to the paper on that. I'd like to begin with the suppression claim. Now, this kind of centers on Warden versus Hayden, and I know that this decision is an old Supreme Court case, but there does, Your Honors, have to be some connection between the individual, the crime, and the place to be searched. And what's important to our purposes here today, it appears to me, is that in the context of the state case, Mr. Carpegna, his arrest warrant and his apprehension had been worked up separately and apart from the search of his home and the taking of the first computer, the HP Pavilion computer. If we could, even in the context of this record, think about the second indictment, or I'm sorry, the arrest on the first indictment. And I know this might be a little fuzzy, but I think it'll come clear. The government waits through the spring and arrests Mr. Carpegna on the first federal indictment. When that happens, there's a search warrant in hand for the second computer because the government knows that Mr. Carpegna is back out on the internet with a different computer. Now, contrast that to the working up of the state case. The state case, he has an arrest warrant sworn out separate and apart based on the touching of the child. And the search warrant process is separate from that process, from that arrest process. So we know, and this is a component of Warden versus Hayden, that there is nothing that this search aids in terms of Mr. Carpegna's apprehension. The child pornography, going into look in his house for child pornography, does not aid in his apprehension on the child sexual assault offense, which is being investigated at the time. So that's one prong we have down. So the next question is, does it aid in his conviction on the sexual assault? And the answer to that is no, it doesn't. There's nothing in the search warrant affidavit that makes a connection or a nexus between the sexual assault offense and the child pornography offenses. It seems like it's kind of a throwaway. The affidavit says, well, I know that these individuals that are involved in sexual offenses may have this material on their computers, and we want to search for it.
We've upheld warrants based on affidavits that made similar law enforcement professional opinion judgments, if you will, haven't we?
Well, you have, maybe. The answer is yes. Warrants have been upheld. I'll concede the point. But the context here is just a little bit different. First is to the qualitative nature of the assertions in the affidavit. What is the nexus between the two? There's no expertise set forth other than some classes or some training that has been taken, apparently. It's really a pretty concise and spare affidavit. And having said that, there doesn't seem to be any real connection between the child pornography offense or the child pornography evidence, I'll call it that, and the child sex offense. And that seems to be a freestanding...
Go back to the qualifications. I guess the question is how much is enough. The affidavit basically says that not only does he take the basic training, but he's taken specific training related to child offenses, and he's been involved in a number of investigations. So that seems to be fairly standard in the kind of things we've upheld. I mean, does he need to list the date and time or the substance of the course? What's missing?
But that doesn't alter the fact. I think there's a difference between, Your Honor, respectfully, between an individual making an assertion as an expert, or if we take that's what the affidavit is trying to accomplish here, and the requirement under Warden versus Hayden that there be a connection between the offense being investigated and the evidence being sought.
You seem to be challenging on both grounds.
I said,
the first ground is he's not qualified, you said, and I'm asking you what more would he need before he then goes on, and that's the second point as to whether he's linked it up sufficiently. So are you challenging or not challenging his qualifications?
I am challenging the qualifications. The nature of the assertion is boilerplate language. It doesn't say what it's based on in actuality. There's no data. There's no number of investigations that the individual has been involved in. There's nothing to detail what the nexus is between the two things and why we should trust this particular experience to marry the two things together.
I mean, the difficulty I'm having is that this reads to me like most affidavits that get approved. I mean, they tell you what their experience is, and then they tell you through experience, training, investigations, and cases I've been involved in, X. And in this case, the X is that there's a connection between people amassing child pornography and interest in pedophilia and crimes against children. So what I'm trying to understand from you, in light of our prior cases that uphold precisely this kind of affidavit, is what's missing here.
Beyond telling Your Honor
in those other cases.
Beyond telling Your Honor that there's insufficient detail in the affidavit, I don't have anything to offer.
Do you have any case that you think would be the most supportive of the position you're taking?
Your Honor, I believe there is a case cited in the blue brief that talks about a decision of this court that talks about boilerplate language of an expert in an affidavit, and I would rely on that.
Okay.
What if the officer had said, in my experience, in these cases, sometimes there is child pornography, and it may involve pictures of the victim. Would that have been sufficient?
I think so.
What if he had said, instead of that, if he had said, and it may involve pornography, in my experience, these are often connected to pornography, and it may involve children of a similar age. They may have been acting out here as a result of having seen pornography of children of the same age.
Well, that seems a little more distant, but I might get there if there was more information set forth in the affidavit. On the first point Your Honor made, there was some specific questioning of the affidavit writer here, asking him, did you suspect that pictures had been taken of this individual child that had been involved in the sexual assault? And he said no to that. And I asked him, well, had you had that information, would it have been material to you, and would you have put that in the warrant application? And he said yes. So I think that changes the outcome here if we have those kind of facts, but we don't have those kind of facts here, Your Honor. What we have is a guy getting arrested in state court for a touching offense and then working up a search warrant application for a premises some substantial distance away where the parties, the individuals, didn't live together for several months, and saying, well, I'm going to go up there and search for evidence of the sexual assault. And there's...
Well, the affidavit said that it was looking for evidence of motive or intent. And if you'd been looking for pornographic images of similarly aged children, would that have been evidence of motive or intent?
No. No, not. I mean, we could keep pulling in, I guess, what ifs, Your Honor. I believe I can make the representation that the sexual assault statute that we're dealing with here would have a knowing state of mind attached to it. I can't see really on any basis what the relevance of the child pornographic evidence would be in the context of the sexual assault case.
We recently had a case where that involved an affidavit where the investigation was into massage parlors as a front for prostitution. And the affidavit sought a warrant to search the owner of the massage parlor's home. And the agent said, it's my experience based on X number of years of investigating these cases that operators of these kind of fronts often stash money at home. And I think we upheld the affidavit and the warrant in that case. Assume that that's the case. How's that different from what we have here?
Well, I think there's a natural flow or a natural nexus between the illicit proceeds, their collection, and their storage. I think it's within the realm of possibility that an individual that's running one of those businesses and hiding the money so he doesn't have to pay taxes or whatever, that it will be found in that location. A case can be made for that. The celebrated case of the congressman with the money in the refrigerator. I think you can make a case for that. I think these facts are different, and I just ask the court to please consider that. As I close up here, I want to address this double jeopardy claim. I did not find a decision of this court that addressed these kind of facts. We did see the Omilda case from the Second Circuit. I did cite that case to Judge Malloy. He did take a look at it. Judge Malloy is terrific. I just love him as a judge. He's just a wonderful guy and been a mentor to me. I just think he got it wrong here.
This was two different periods of time.
Involving
two different computers, right?
I understand that, Your Honor, but what we're trying to do here is draft in the second indictment, and I think that's a seductive thing to do, is just to lay the two papers next to each other and say, well, any fool could see. But, Your Honors, that's not the test in Omilda. Omilda says what was known at the time that the individual pled to the first indictment. And we tried to emphasize that in our briefing, and I'm here to emphasize it in my last minute. The second indictment really has little to do with that analysis. It's what was known at the time. And if your honors could take a look at volume 2 of the ER at page 297, there's a nice chart set out there of what was known when. And your honors can see that the government knew about all of the images. And the place that I'll leave it and maybe reserve 15 seconds for rebuttal would be that there doesn't have to be a comparative assessment of the two indictments.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Mr. Mercer?
It pleases the Court. I'm Bill Mercer. I'm the United States Attorney in Montana, and I appear on behalf of my colleague, Marcia Hurd. I want to turn to the probable cause determination that was made by the state district judge that's been the scope of most of the questioning, and to argue that the case law in this circuit sets forth that there is deference owed to that probable cause determination by the judge, and that in reviewing that, it's really essential to look at whether the district judge had a fair probability, not certainty, about the facts in this case and whether they established probable cause, and that in doing so, the state district judge should have looked at the totality of the circumstances. And as set forth in Volume 3 of the excerpts of record, where we start with both the application made by the police officer in Dillon, Montana, and then the affidavit in support of that, it is the government's position that this court should affirm based upon the authority, the in-bank authority in Gord, and then the subsequent case of Hill. Here, the facts as...
Counsel, could the images of child pornography that were found on the computer have been introduced in a criminal prosecution for the offense of touching?
I don't believe so, because those images that were eventually found based upon the search warrant did not include images of the child who is the daughter of the complainant.
Clearly, if we had found pictures of the little girl, that would have been relevant. Now, the affidavit didn't say we're looking for pictures of the little girl, because in my experience as an officer, people who engage in these kinds of offensive touchings frequently have pornography on their home and have pictures of the kids they're touching.
True, but as you noted, Judge Bybee, that in the application, which is set forth in 584 of the excerpts of record, the officer specifically noted that he was looking for items of evidence to corroborate the commission of the offense of sexual assault on a minor and evidence to establish means, motive, and intent to commit said crime.
Okay. Now, means, motive, and intent are things that might have been introduced in a criminal trial, right?
Sure.
Okay, now back to my original question. Were the images that they discovered on the... These were kiddie porn. It was kiddie porn stuff that they found on his computer.
Right, because we knew, based upon the complainant's testimony, that she had on two occasions seen this defendant viewing child pornography on his computer.
Okay, now... And it turns out he actually did have that stuff on his computer. So
correct.
No surprise.
Correct.
Now, could that evidence have been introduced in his trial for touching this child?
Well,
you told me no, but you found exactly what you were looking for, and the officer said we went to intent and motive and so forth.
Well, this officer also said, at the suppression hearing, this officer also indicated on page 534 that he was looking for images of the victim engaged in sexual contact with this defendant. So, it's based upon his testimony, and I think, I guess to answer your question, could a prosecutor say, we want to try to get this under 404B. I think that we would not seek to do that because I think it's too attenuated. But the question of whether there was probable cause based upon the affidavit and inferences that the judge could draw, not only do we look to the observations the complainant made of child pornography, the allegations made by the child of the touching, the observation made by the woman, the mother, and then... certainly the district court judge was entitled to draw inferences from the law. And I point to Judge McEwen's opinion for the en-banc court in Gord, where she notes most collectors are persons who have a sexual attraction of children. Collectors act like pack rats because they have difficulty obtaining images of child pornography, and so on. There's more there that I won't read into the record. But I think the district judge had the ability to not only look to the law, look to the affidavit, and draw inferences to say, well, we've got child pornography being observed, this person observing child pornography on two occasions. We have touchings on two occasions. And it is certainly possible, based upon those observations and what we know from the law about pedophiles, that there will be images of that hands-on offense taking place that depicts this child. So it was in the government's position, taking all of those things together, there was certainly a reasonable probability, based upon this circuit's case law, that would be found on that computer. I want to turn to the double jeopardy argument very quickly, because we do want to talk about those dates that, first of all, on a pure double jeopardy analysis, do we have a successive prosecution taken by one sovereign for the same facts against the same defendant on two occasions? And the argument there is certainly not. The dates in question, as set forth in the initial indictment, show that that conduct ends on the 6th of March of 2006. The period of time in the second indictment is very different, and under a pure double jeopardy analysis, we should not be reversed on those grounds for the second indictment. And even if you look to this Almeida test from the Second Circuit, what did a reasonable person know? Well, clearly, Mr. Carpanian knew from the plain language of that first indictment that the grand jury had charged conduct only continuing through March 6th. He also knew what forfeiture charge had been brought by the government. He knew, it's certainly possible his counsel didn't know, but he knew that he had engaged in conduct in Missoula beyond the date set forth in the initial indictment, and he had procured a different computer than was set forth as part of the forfeiture claim in the first indictment. So the government doesn't believe that there is any issue that is something that should be subject to a reversal with respect to the double jeopardy claim. And unless...
You concede the Davenport issue.
We concede the Davenport issue with respect to the first indictment. But I should note, there isn't a Davenport issue with the second indictment, because it was the conviction only pertains to the second count, possession. And as you know, the judge ran some of that time concurrent and some of it consecutive.
Okay. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you very much.
You have a few seconds, as you noted, for rebuttal, counsel.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Your Honors, I just wanted to mention here on page 5 of the reply brief, I do set out the testimony of the warrant applicant, who expressly disavows that there was any connection between the victim in the child sexual offense and picture taking and so on. And I set out that testimony.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. The case just argued will be submitted for decision, and the court will stand in recess for the day.